And I'm very happy now to welcome to the program David King Dunaway. He is a professor at UNM. He is the DJ of the Saturday morning folk music program on KUNM in Albuquerque. His newest book is called A Route 66 Companion, and tonight he will be at Collected Works Bookstore talking about his new book. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Happy to be here.
So, I saw Route 66 Companion. I thought, here we go, guidebook, pictures of diners. This is a completely different thing. This is a literary compilation of all kinds of works by very well-known and lesser-known authors. What is this book? How did you put it together?
I think it's the first anthology of the world's most famous road. Now, we could debate that one. But what I decided to do was to try and find a different story for Route 66, different from nostalgia. That's how many of us think of this old road. Well, of course, it went right through Santa Fe, coming up the old Santa Fe Trail and down Water Street. And in the first incarnation, later on it was straightened out and didn't go up north from Santa Rosa, but went straight across to Albuquerque. And I realized that I work on Route 66, and I never even noticed it. I began to start paying some attention, and the more I did, the more I had the feeling that there was another Route 66 out there, an older Route 66, which was a corridor across time as well as place. And in that corridor, there were many tales which have not been told. So a Route 66 companion offers an alternative to the Coke bottles and Lindy dancing view of this road that people come from all over the world to visit, including visiting Santa Fe. And so I decided to try and put together an anthology that would range from the buffalo hunting days of Route 66 through its heyday in the 30s and 40s to the point at which in 1985 it became, decommissioned, I guess is the word that they use. But people are still driving it, people are still looking for it, but now they have a different way of thinking about it. That different way is a way of understanding the peoples who were here before Route 66 and who were displaced by Route 66, the African Americans, the Hispanics, the Native Americans who had Route 66 come through their reservation without anyone asking any permission. And so when you add it all up, there are different ways of looking at this road, and I'm trying to offer a new one, a companion to those of us who maybe can't always get on the old highway, but want to see it across time and place.
And what you have done is made this anthology of so many different voices, and I couldn't help but wondering, how in the world did you find and identify all of these different pieces? There's dozens of them. And I mean, for example, let's say a mystery author had a little passage in their book that takes place on Route 66. It's in this anthology. I can't even imagine how much reading, kind of at random, you had to do to find these things.
Well, it's funny you should ask, Mary Charlotte, because actually I'm the son of an anthologist. And I grew up in a house where books were floor to ceiling, and I still kind of feel most comfortable in bookish environments. Raymond Chandler wrote about finding a gold doubloon on Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles, and that's in the book. Ross McDonald witnesses an environmental catastrophe out in the basin near Los Angeles, and that's in the book. So some of our great mystery writers are represented, and I guess I just read a lot.
And have been reading over quite a long period of time, too, which is a beautiful thing to be able, I think, to draw on so many years of experience.
Well, in fairness, where this whole project began, a new Route 66, some have called it, is when I started working for NPR and Public Radio International, PRI, in doing a radio documentary series with music on Route 66 back at the beginning of the century. For NPR, I did a series of postcards from 66, and then there was three full-length, one-hour documentaries. And in doing those, I probably interviewed about 150 people. And since then, I've been working up in Santa Fe with the National Park Service Route 66 Corridor Preservation Program, which is the place where America places its trust and its hopes for reviving interest in Route 66. And they have been very sympathetic to different takes. As a matter of fact, they just organized a Indian Voices on Route 66, in which members of seven tribes from New Mexico and Arizona had a chance to present their take on what this road meant and how it was built. So if you listen carefully, there are all these voices out there.
Yeah.
And I think that I tried to capture a few of them. And so anyway, the radio series is called Across the Tracks, a Route 66 story. And you can find it at my website, which is just davidkdunaway.com.
One of the Indian stories, there are so many details that are just interesting in themselves, that at a certain point in history, Route 66 was a road where a lot of Indians who didn't have driver's licenses drove because there was no highway patrol there.
Right. It's each community claimed 66 in a different way. And so one of the Indian poets I talked to in the book, Lance Henson, talks about how for the Cheyenne, that was the road that the police did not police. And so it became their road. It ran right by one of the first ceremonies that they had when they were moved out to Oklahoma. And so it's a place with special memories for a lot of people. In the book also has Leslie Silko's story about natives looking at Route 66 from a Laguna perspective. But it's not just about them. It's about Sylvia Plath sleeping in the desert with her husband Ted Hughes on Route 66. Joan Didion reflecting on how Southern California changed through Route 66. Of course, John Steinbeck's classic Grapes of Wrath.
And the stories, of course, about the Depression bring to mind, I mean, I think it's a very important thing when you're talking about Route 66 to remember how much migration there was and how much suffering there was in contrast to the kind of nostalgic cliche that we have about that road.
Right. For many Americans, when they think of Route 66, they think of Henry Fonda scratching his head and looking out across the plains, out hoping that California's somewhere down the road, in John Ford's famous film of Grapes of Wrath. But there, it has such complexity. Like any subject, you could almost begin pulling its pieces apart. And for me, I found myself pulling apart the layers of pop culture, the layers of merchandising, and trying to get at, well, perhaps a soul can't be said to have for a road, but some of its spirit anyway, and particularly some of its diversity. The image that we have of the Depression and how the Okies and the Arkies made their way, that's accurate. But a lot of people don't know they used the same road to go back from California after the war industries closed down. So the migration has been there dating back to the Indians leaving Tulsa and following the breaks on the South Canadian River. And that's where we have Route 66 coming from, is those old animal trails and the people who followed them. So for me, it's a great pageant of history. And now, finally, we can bring some other voices into the story.
We're talking to David King Dunaway about his book, A Route 66 Companion. Now, the method that you used for organizing this book is what you call a bioregional approach. What does that mean?
Well, we're lucky in New Mexico to have some of the great cultural geographers who've been looking at our culture and our land for many years. I wrote a book called Riding the Southwest, which was an introduction to our region based on short biographies of a number of prominent figures. And in doing so, I began to see all these voices of the Southwest and how they would merge. Part of the research that came out of Riding the Southwest was a new understanding of how the land influenced people. I teach a course in the fall called Riding the Southwest, and it's all about writing about place. And our literature here in the Southwest has always been noted for our sensitivity to place from the peoples who've lived here and so connected to the land. So bioregionalism is just a recognition of that ancient fact, that the contours of a land and its contents and its peoples determine the culture and the economic activity and the social activity that's there. And so for me, I actually see five Route 66s, starting from Chicago. There's a Prairie 66. Then you go over that hump in Tulsa and out into the plains of Oklahoma for Plains 66. Then you finally cross New Mexico and you begin to rise into the mountains. That's Mountain 66 across Arizona. Then you hit the desert in the Mojave. That's Desert 66. And finally, you have a Coastal 66. So different from all these other pieces of the puzzle. And in each case, Route 66, unlike the freeway, wound around, went up, and it went down, and it followed the glacial outwash, and it followed the crossings that people had made even thousands of years before, and it followed the railroad. And so it had a different texture because the railroad largely had to follow the lay of the land. And so in taking over the railroad's grade, 66 often did the same. And so for me, you can understand a road that connects all these different cultures and places and peoples together by understanding how that land works and you know, where you can dry farm and where you have to irrigate and where there, you know, tall grass that brings the buffalo and where there's short grass and back and forth. So for me, that's what bioregionalism means. It's understanding the road in the context of the land.
The last section is, it's called The Future of 66, and I think it's sort of funny. You have some, what do you call it, a rocket scientist looking at Route 66, and then you have Aldous Huxley. How did you decide to do that last section?
Well, partly it's this notion that Route 66 isn't all behind us, that it's very much in the present, in its revival years since 1985. This was the road that wouldn't die. And as soon as people in Illinois began taking down the Route 66 signs, someone came along behind them and, you know, put them back up again. It's a very grassroots revival movement. And so I started with the past, sure, the Beals Trail and the camels humping down Route 66, and then went into historical periods from the road's beginning in 1926 to now. And then finally, a look into our own time. And I didn't want to end there. So I found someone that worked at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and I asked him, well, okay, we've had all these other vehicles down Route 66. What about rockets? And he gives us his opinion. And then I turned to literature and realized that in Brave New World, if you remember that book, there's a period where Bernard Marx and his girlfriend leave London in a rocket to visit New Mexico. And as I traced the places along the way, I discovered they were following the road that Aldous Huxley followed when he first came to America in 1937, and that was Route 66. So perhaps I'm pushing it. There's also a science fiction piece in there that describes New Mexico as having one of the world's largest spaceports not far from Route 66. So I think this is all in our future, and I think it's in 66's future, too. If we think of it as a corridor across time and place, then the future holds new challenges for Route 66. And it's so exciting that here in Santa Fe, you are at the center of the revival movement in Route 66. What points us towards the future is this National Park Service Route 66 Corridor Preservation Program. It's trying not just to restore, but to open up 66 to new interpretations.
I think the book is really valuable in a number of ways, including just a way of reflecting on American identity and the sort of crazy diversity of that identity and the so many different voices and experiences and landscapes that make us who we are that are hard to understand and hard to remember.
Well, it's not coincidental in the sense that I got Berkeley's first doctorate in American Studies. And in my earlier work on folk music, writing the life of Pete Seeger, and other books, Singing Out, which is the story of America's folk music revivals, I found myself sort of preparing for this process. And for me, yes, it's a broad avenue into American history, but it's also a Trojan horse. Because who doesn't like Route 66? Who objects to this grand old road? And yet, hidden within this road, perhaps packed inside the horse, ready to be unpacked, is a whole new way for me of coming to terms with a multicultural history this time around, and an environmental history this time around, subjects that weren't in my high school textbooks when I studied history.
David Dunaway is the author of a Route 66 companion, or I guess I would have to say editor, of this book, and he will be tonight at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe at 6 o'clock. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
This is fun. I love KSFR.
Thank you. I'd like now to welcome Angela Gabriel. She's a musician and specifically a marimba player and here to talk about the Santa Fe Marimba Festival, which starts tomorrow. Welcome.
Hi.
So marimba, and we'll hear just a little bit of music at the end of this segment, is an African instrument. It's a lot of things. Tell us what the marimba is.
It's kind of a version of a xylophone. And in Greek, xylo means wood. So xylo, wood, phone is sound. So it's an instrument where the wood is making the sound. And so it includes xylophones, marimbas, balafones, djili, instruments all over the world that are very similar, where you take different size pieces of wood, and depending on the length, it changes the pitch. And then you put some kind of resonator underneath, either a gourd or a PVC pipe or a brass tube or aluminum tube, and that helps push the sound out. And you pretty much see that same thing happen all over the world.
And so do we have actually marimba players from all over the world at this festival?
We do. We have marimba players from Croatia. We have marimba players from the United States who play African music, from Zimbabwe, Ghana. We have people who teach at Berkeley. We have people from Belgium, all over. It's really exciting.
And do each of these places, I mean, you play African marimba in Croatian. Do they play Croatian marimba? Is there a tradition there?
You know, I don't really know a specific answer to that question, but I do know there are a few famous Croatian marimba players, and the music that they play is very Eastern European sounding, and it's they'll play music from all over the world, too. I mean, you'll have people play Bach no matter where they're from. But then this Croatian style, it's really beautiful. And in fact, some of my favorite pieces for marimba have been written by Croatian composers.
So there will be not only workshops for players and so on, but there's going to be a number of concerts over the next several days.
Yeah, some really good, lots of variety. On Thursday, June 7th at 7 p.m., St. Francis Auditorium, the concert is Marimba Roots, African to Latin America. And so there'll be some local players. There'll also be Valerie Naranjo that we spoke with a couple months ago.
Who's absolutely wonderful and a total virtuoso.
Yes, beautiful, beautiful woman and player. There'll be some Ugandan Amadinda. If you're not familiar with that, it's really amazing. They play one big instrument where they face each other. And you have sometimes, 10 people all playing on this one instrument. We'll also hear some Mexican marimba. Gordon Stout is playing his classic piece, Three Mexican Dances, that, is kind of, if you're a marimba player who went to college, you played his
piece. You played
piece.
That piece.
Yes. And that's Thursday. Then Friday, June 8th at 8 p.m., this is at the Lenzic this time, not St. Francis Auditorium. It's world music and Latin jazz with Victor Mendoza, who's an amazing player, teaches at Berklee School of Music. Gordon Stout, again, will be playing. Ivana Bilic, who is from Croatia. Bert Dalton and his trio will be playing with Victor Mendoza. It'll be a very exciting night. And then there's a free concert Saturday, June 9th, at St. Francis Auditorium, 12:30. It's called Wood That Sings. That's
nice.
My favorite. And you'll hear...
Is it more for young people?
It's for everybody. It's for everybody, because you'll hear some more music from Valerie, and then also some music for flute and marimba. Sam Lunt, who's one of the organizers, he'll be playing one of his pieces. Douglas Walter, who teaches in Colorado, he'll come and play several arrangements that he's done of standards and gospel. So it'll be really fun. Also, I should say, Saturday morning, there is a free thing for kids. I'm doing a workshop with kids ages 8 and up.
Nice.
Saturday at St. Francis Auditorium from 9 to 10:30. And we'll do some Zimbabwean-style marimba. I have to kind of make it for ages 8 and up, just because any younger than that, sometimes they're just too short short attention span, and also just short stature.
Oh.
They can't actually reach up high enough to play. And so we're trying to limit that. And also we're limited in terms of how many instruments and how many pairs of mallets we have. So it is first come, first serve, but it is free. And it'll be a lot of fun. Hopefully it'll be mostly people who have not played before. So that way they can have the opportunity to try.
This is a really big deal, the Santa Fe Marimba Festival.
It is.
You've been organizing it for quite a while.
Well, I haven't been in on a lot of the organization, like the pull your hair out kind of stuff. I was in on the fun stuff, the brainstorming early on. But Sam has really worked, and Tom McGuire, both of those guys have worked really, really hard to make this happen. And things have really worked out. I talked to Sam a few times on the phone the last couple of days, and I was amazed at how laid back he sounded considering what's going on. He's been doing a great job. There's also one more concert Saturday night at 6 o'clock. It's called From the Silk Road to Bach. And that's going to be a great concert at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center.
So, and a lot of people, a lot of pieces on that Saturday night.
Yes.
So if people want more information, they can go to SantaFeMarimbaFestival.org, which, by the way, is a very beautiful website, and find out about registering and about the concert schedule and everything.
Yes. And if I could just say, the concerts on Thursday evening, that's general admission. On Friday evening and Saturday evening is reserved seating. And all three of those concerts, you can contact the Lenzic box office,
988-1234.
And Saturday afternoon at 12:30 is free. Oh, and I forgot to mention, Friday evening at 6 o'clock on the plaza, Jaka is playing.
Oh,
and
nice.
Yes. And so
our
own marimba group. And it's actually, you'll see, even more than just marimba, they've gone through a lot of different phases, and they used to be particularly marimbas. Now it's marimba and there's zimbira, which is the Zimbabwean thumb piano, guitar, bass, drums, dancers. It's a fun time, and that's free. Saturday afternoon is free, and the kids' performance is free, or kids' workshop.
Santa Fe Marimba Festival. Angela Gabriel is musician, marimba player. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And we're going to go out with a little bit of marimba music. Naranjo, who is going to be taking part in the Santa Fe Marimba Festival, and that was from her disc Liwa's Dream. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Ann Hillerman. She's a writer. She's co-founder of Word Harvest Workshops. She's a restaurant reviewer for the Albuquerque Journal and the Journal North. And Deborah Madison joins us. She's a chef, teacher, author of many cookbooks, now gardener, and lover of food and all things food-related. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you. Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
It's nice to have you both back on the air. So you are running all these workshops, Ann Hillerman, and you, Deborah, are actually teaching a writing workshop called Writing Your Life Through the Lens of Food.
Yes.
I think that's such an intriguing idea. What does that mean?
Well, I can give you some personal background. Patrick and I lived in Ireland for a few years ago, and I was stuck in a house with nothing to do, so I decided to write a memoir. And it turned out to really be looking at everything through food, since that's what my life has been centered around professionally, but also emotionally, and I think in other ways too. And it was very revealing to me about myself, and not necessarily in a way that made me feel terrific, you know, but then it became something to work on that I've worked with the last 5 years. And I think people have different things that are central to their lives, but we're all involved with food one way or another. And there are always issues around it, struggles around it, joys around it, all kinds of things. So it just seems like a good place to start from if you want to try writing something of a memoir or about your life.
What were some of the revelations that you had about yourself when starting to write about your life in terms of food?
Well, one of them was, is why didn't I go to graduate school instead? That came up. I thought,
what do you mean?
Well, I don't know. It was just like, I often wish I had done more in the way of formal study that wasn't food related. But I mean, I found my own reasons for being attracted to food and that I hadn't noticed. And for example, my parents were diametrically opposite each other in their approach to food. So, you know, under the eye of one, the glass was always half empty and we were hungry. Under the eye of the other, there's plenty to go around and not to worry. And so I got caught in this struggle. And I think that that really explained a lot to me why it was so important. And, you know, things I did that expressed my response to one parent or the other.
Were they also diametrically opposed in the sense of, oh, let's have hot dogs again versus let's have something really fancy and fabulous?
Yeah, my mother was a horrible cook and skimpy. There was, you know, everything was about... She spent the food money, her food budget, to make sure we had music lessons, you know, as kids, and dance lessons and art lessons. And so we're always hungry, you know. Whereas my father, you know, he wasn't, when my mother would go away, he'd take her to the airport. He'd come home with shopping bags full of pot roasts and steaks and all this, you know, kind of Midwest comfort food, and it would always be in the middle of summer and 110 degrees outside, and we'd be eating, you know, pot roast and pie.
Oh, so, my goodness. And so, you became a chef with that background. That's so interesting. I mean, do you think that that kind of food attitudes and weird attitudes pushed you in that direction?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It did. Because the first time I had food that was really good, when I was 16 and my parents had gone to Europe on sabbatical, and I was farmed out to this family who didn't have four kids, who had two incomes and who were gourmets and had lived in France forever, suddenly I had my first good food, and it was like this revelation. I didn't know it was supposed to be good. You know?
Oh, so. That's so interesting. I was wondering something. When I was about 15 or 16... I started to appreciate good food of the kind you're talking about for the first time. And up until then, I was just eating M&Ms and hamburgers and sometimes put the M&Ms on the hamburgers. just ate Dr. Pepper and junk. Just ate junk. And the, you know, not junky fare that my mother and father fed to me. I mean, it wasn't that they gave me all those things, but given. And then something completely changed. And I wondered if... And I wonder today, maybe you can say something about this, whether the palate matures at a certain point in your teenage, just the way the rest of your body is maturing?
I don't know. I think there are probably different things that go on, and that's what somebody would discover in writing about their life in terms of food. I don't know that it's really a palate maturity, but it may be another kind of maturity, or certain questions are solved and answered for you that you don't have to... You know, you don't have to put M&Ms on your hamburgers anymore, which would be a kind of maturity, I suppose. But, you know, certain patterns, I think, stay with us for quite a long time before we're willing to give them up. And it's interesting to see what those are.
It's such an interesting approach, and maybe it's been done before, but I've never heard of it. The idea of, because everybody... On some level, or a lot of people are kind of interested in themselves and their own stories, but that particular lens is something I've never thought of before, I've never seen before.
Well, I've given this class a number of times in other places, and it's always so interesting what people come up with, and it's so different from my own. But I also want to talk about, in this class, certain craft aspects. Like, I think there are a lot of people around who maybe are at a point in their life where they would like to write a collection of recipes for their children or their family or for someone who's getting married. And, you know, how do you write a recipe and make it work so that it reads and is actually effective? There are little things that one learns to do. And there's the matter of the head notes, which are what introduces the recipe, which is where the real creative part of doing a cookbook or a recipe book comes to play, and it's a lot of fun. And you know, and I have a bunch of head notes I read to people so they can see all these different ways in which
what kind of things do you write in your head notes?
Well, I mean, that's the place where you have to seduce your reader. This is wonderful. This is easy. This will feed 10 and you won't even know you've cooked, you know, or whatever it is. But, or it can be something very, very different, something very literary, something historical. It doesn't have to be personal. I mean, there's certain cliches that are so endlessly tiresome, like this is quick and easy. And although it looks like a lot of ingredients, it's really fast. You know, it's like, please, let's not say anything like this. But it's a great opportunity to build the context of a recipe so that it's not just floating out there. I mean, we don't need recipes floating. There's a million of them. We need them to be anchored to your own experience. And so we'll get a little practice doing that.
So, Deborah, could you say this was a recipe that my grandmother fixed and I remember eating it at her summer house in Maine? Would that be appropriate for a head note?
Sure, absolutely. Or I remember eating an omelet in Mexico City when I was homesick. And it was so disappointing because it was cooked in oil, not butter.
Right.
Like my grandmother's omelets.
Right.
And that made all the difference in the world. And then you can say something about fat, in fact, is a really important determinant of flavor and taste and culture and where you're from and who you are. You know, it just really is.
It's interesting that now that there's so many internet recipes, like if you go onto Epicurious and look at a recipe, not only are there the head notes of whoever wrote the recipe, but then hundreds or at least dozens of people have made the recipe and commented on it. And that's interesting, too.
Yeah. My favorite comments are, I didn't make it the way you said, and I didn't think it was a very good recipe.
I know, or you read them and they've changed just about every ingredient.
Yeah, right.
They say, well, I like this, but I didn't have any butter, so I used olive oil.
Right.
I didn't have any pecan, so I used walnuts.
Right. Yeah. I didn't have any raisins, so I used turnips.
And actually, a lot of times they don't have head notes. They're just floating there in space.
Right.
You know, and I think, why would I want to turn my energy to this recipe without somebody telling me something about why it moved them?
Right. Right.
And that can be so many different things that can have played a particular role in their life, or it represents an adventure or a personal history, or, you know.
And it's all a way of cultivating awareness, memory, attention to detail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Very interesting. We're talking to Deborah Madison and Anne Hillerman. Now, Deborah, you will be teaching this class on the 14th of July, and there's a lot of other classes. They're just, what are they, one day workshops?
That's right. Yeah, they're from 9 to 4. We're doing them this year at La Tienda out in El Dorado, which is a really nice space. There's a couple restaurants out there. People can walk around. You know, we can go outside. They've been really sweet people to work with. Besides Deborah's, well, let me go back a little bit. We're doing some workshops on the craft of writing and some workshops on the business of writing. And Deborah's kind of falls in between because she's going to talk a little bit about both of those.
Uh-huh.
We're ending the season with a writer named Cindy Bellinger, who has started her own publishing company. And she's going to talk to people about how to publish your own book.
Which is a huge thing now.
Yeah.
For two reasons. One, everybody thinks they can write and they've got a computer and they can do self-publishing. And the publishing industry is in such terrible shape.
Right, right. We were really happy to have Cindy working with us. She has also served on the board of New Mexico Book Association. So she knows a lot about the publishing business. And she originally was going to self-publish, and that was why she started this little publishing company. So she's going to be happy to share what she's learned about not only publishing, but also the promotion and distribution, the whole nine yards of that.
That sounds very useful.
Very useful and interesting. And, I mean, I think that's the key. You can self-publish your own book very cheaply, but who's going to read it? And how are you going to get it in their hands?
That's right.
Yeah.
Or in their devices.
That's true.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, not everybody is as lucky as Deborah, where you have a name where there's already so much credibility behind it.
Right.
And then we're having a couple workshops that are going to be focused mostly on the craft of writing, a workshop on how to develop good characters, and a workshop on how to find the story that's really right for you to tell.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I think it's a really nice combination of sort of the nuts and bolts and the more kind of creative, free-flowing stuff.
How do you find the story that is the one you want to tell? And how do you know whether that's fiction or nonfiction?
That's a good question. And I don't know, but I'm Kate Horsley, who's a writer from Albuquerque. She's published 6 books, and that's what she's going to be talking about. And her books, some of her novels have a real strong memoir component, and some are historical novels. So I'm looking forward to hearing what she has to say about that.
Very interesting.
I took one of the classes from James McGrath, and it was wonderful. It was such a lovely day to have a whole day and well-paced to be able to write and to read out loud, which is another important part of writing, is reading out loud.
And right.
Yeah.
I think these days there are so many online seminars, and I think they certainly have their purpose, but there's nothing quite like taking a day just for yourself, away from the office, away from the phone, away from the computer, and being with other people who share your passion for good writing. And not only interacting with the instructor, as people will have a chance to do with Deborah, but interacting to the other people who've kind of self-selected to spend the day that way. To me, it seems it's almost like a mini retreat.
You know, I was talking to somebody the other day about a project, and he said, well, we don't have to meet. We can do it online. And I was like, but it's nice to meet. And
yes.
And he said, that's so Santa Fe.
I think it's so human.
I think it's so human, yeah. Too.
Yeah, that's what we thought. We thought, sure, we could do these classes online, but isn't it fun to just spend a day with people?
Yeah, and yeah. If you think about the material that you are eventually going to be working with as an author, it's not going to be what you learned online.
Right.
It's going to be the interactions you actually had in something that we might call the real world.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, and being with people. I mean, when you're writing about people. Even if it's you writing a memoir, you're still writing about people. You're putting yourself in a context of others. And so we're kind of losing the knack of that, I think, in a lot of ways. So it was wonderful to go to a seminar and have a day.
And I think so much of writing is solitary, too.
Tell me.
But it's great to have a chance to be with people who kind of understand what that's like. And who can, I mean, if you are seem distracted about something, you know, they'll understand that, oh, yeah, she's still back in the book that she left on her computer.
Now, Deborah, you were a chef, and then you started writing cookbooks. Was that a transition for you? I would think that being a professional chef, there's a lot of that which is visual and sensuous and nonverbal, and then putting that on a page.
Uh-huh.
That's a whole new craft that you're having to learn.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, the first book I wrote, I had already left Greens. I'd left the restaurant. And then I was asked to come back from Italy, where I was living, and write this book. And I didn't have a clue what I was doing or how to make a recipe or anything. But I got through it. And at the end, I realized I like doing this. You know, I want to try it again, but I want it to be a more personal book, not this restaurant, you know, image. And I like doing that, too. Now I'd like to get away from putting everything in terms of a recipe and be able to. In fact, I am doing it in this book that I'm writing. But it's very hard. People, publishers, they don't want you to stray too much from what you're known for.
Right.
It's very frustrating.
Which really inhibits creativity.
Yeah, it does.
What are you working on now?
It's a book called Vegetable Literacy, 10 Plant Families in Your Kitchen. So it's looking, it does have recipes, but it's really looking at 10 major plant families that provide a lot of the common foods that we cook and how the foods in families relate to one another as a way of, I think if you're a cook and you understand that everything in the Asteraceae family tends to be bitter and difficult and argue with wine, but they're all incredibly potent plants, you know, like artichokes and radicchio and lettuce and cardoons. And
those are all related?
Yeah, they're all related.
And they all argue with wine?
Well, they're difficult plants.
It sounds like somebody's family.
Yeah, well, it's a family, you know. But then you begin to say, oh, okay, well, gosh, I've got radicchio and I've got one artichoke. Maybe it makes sense to put them together. And guess what? It does.
So the things in the family tend to go well to each other.
Yeah.
With each other.
The mustard family, for example, has all the cabbages in it and mustard. And mustard happens to be a good condiment in one form or another with almost every member of that family.
Oh, interesting.
And they all have the same kinds of flowers and morphology.
Oh, you were coming on the air when that comes out. this is very interesting and important.
Yeah.
You would think they probably all have similar nutritional...
They do.
Yeah.
I mean, everything in the Allium family tends to have a lot of sulfur qualities, you know, in it, which are very beneficial. And in another family, it's something else. Again, in the Daisy family, it's inulin, which is a kind of sugar that's very slow to break down. You know, yeah, they do have their characteristics.
This is very interesting. Okay, when does this come out?
About a year from now.
Oh, okay, well, we'll see you in a year to talk about that again. Anne Hillerman, so you've been doing these workshops as well as your writing career for quite a long time.
Yeah, this is our 10th anniversary.
Oh, nice.
The 10th anniversary of Word Harvest. My business partner and I, Jean Schomburg, started it all that time ago. And we first started with one-day workshops, which is what we're doing now. And then after a couple years, we added the Tony Hillerman Writers Conference.
That's right.
Yeah, so that's coming up in November.
Being your father.
Right. Yeah, we wanted to honor him while he was still alive. So, yeah. I mean, so many people were so influenced by his work, and so often people don't say that until after somebody is gone.
Yeah. I know.
So we thought it would be nice to, you know, to start the workshop while he, and also he always enjoyed having an audience, so it worked out well on a lot of different levels.
Excellent.
I think writers do like having an audience because you do spend so much time by yourself. And I spend a lot of time trying to imagine, who is my audience? What do they want to know? What do I need to tell them? Or what's going to be excessive baggage? And, you know, and it, that also, of course, relates to this craft of writing a recipe. Thinking of who your audience is a very big part of it.
Now, Anne, having taught and organized these workshops for 10 years, do you have any alumni who started out beginners or whatever and then have done some successful writing?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I can't really take all the credit for it, of course, although I'd like to. We do a short story contest, and when we first started it, our first winner was a gentleman who was teaching journalism at the University of New Mexico, and I noticed he just has a second book out sort of about the history of media in the United States. University of New Mexico Press has published that. And our second winner was a mystery writer named Craig Johnson, and he's just had characters made into a movie for A&E. And he's on the New York Times bestseller list now.
Excellent.
And then we've had a lot of people who've had I don't want to say lesser success, but they haven't been noticed as much. But for them, it was success to take the book they had always wanted to write and actually hold it in their hand and be able to give it to their family. As Deborah was saying about recipes, there's a tremendous value in just in doing something so your family will have it, as well as doing things that are more commercial successes.
Exactly.
Yeah. I have a folder full of recipes that are written by hand from various family members or friends, people that have sent me, and every once in a while I take it out and look at it, and it has such vibrancy that it nothing else does, you know.
Yeah.
Now that's we're talking about literally by hand, but also the personal connection that my grandmother shared this or my friend in Flagstaff shared this recipe is nice. And we used to have recipe boxes, you know, filled with that kind of
index
thing.
Index cards.
So, you know, this there might be people out there, I suspect there are, who want to do something like that for their own families.
Sure. And there are a lot of people who don't really know how to get started. I mean, they've had these ideas, but they're not writers. So I think that's one real value that our workshops have. They kind of can move people from the idea stage to actually putting words on paper or on the computer. Let them see themselves as writers as well as people with a lot of knowledge and a lot of memories.
Yeah. And the craft is just crucially important for that. Writing that is full of potential but is so poorly crafted that it makes you cringe, it's never going to go anywhere.
Right, that's right.
Word Harvest Writers Workshops are happening all this summer, and for more information you can go to wordharvest.com. You can write to wordharvest@wordharvest.com, and you can also call 505-471-1565. Anne Hillerman is the co-founder of Word Harvest Workshops, and she's a restaurant reviewer for the Albuquerque Journal, and Deborah Madison, chef, teacher, gardener, author of many cookbooks and books on food. And once again, Deborah's class is happening on the 14th of July. It's called Writing Your Life Through the Lens of Food. Thank you, ladies, for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.